Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. This is session 4009, Innovative Ways in which School-Based Healthcare is Aiming to Advance the Development, Health, Safety, Well-Being, and Academic Success of Vulnerable Populations. So we are going to cover it all this morning. I'm Jordana Snyder, and I'd like to introduce my my panelists, Shelia McCann, Tammy Alexander, and Addie Vansel, who also introduce themselves as we move forward and they present their sessions. As I said, I'm Jordana Snyder. This is actually part of a two-part series, two-part presentation on school health and innovative approaches and interventions to address social and emotional health. These innovations occur both inside and outside of the clinic, and the follow-up presentation will cover population-level approaches for school-based health centers to manage chronic stress in urban minorities. So you can see that the social-emotional interventions are linked with the chronic stress and the level of which the intervention occurs and what the location at which the intervention occurs is a little bit different between the two sessions. Everyone's in the right place? Okay, good. Wonderful. So I work at an organization called the School-Based Health Alliance, and I manage a program called Hallways to Help. If you need to reach me, my contact information is provided. And I have no relationships, financial or otherwise, to disclose. So in this first part of the session, our learning objectives will be to synthesize the lessons learned and best practices of two school-based health centers, SBHC's School-Based Health Center, initiatives in addressing social and emotional wellness, and describe the school-based health center initiatives that impact students, families, and school climate. So, show of hands, who has heard of a school-based health center? Oh, you guys are all in the right place. Wonderful. I saw a few folks without their hands up, and just so you know, we're all on the same page at 8:30 this Tuesday morning, midway through the conference. I'll just provide a quick overview. So school-based health centers represent the intersection of health, that includes both public health and primary care, as well as the intersection with that and education. School-based health centers are often run by local health care groups, such as local health departments, local federally qualified health clinics, and other school and health care organizations. The school-based health center represents a shared commitment between the school and the health care organizations in order to support the health, well-being, and academic success of the students. So they're integrally connected. School-based health centers serve students in grades kindergarten through 12th grade, and they operate in the school buildings or in very close proximity to the school buildings. Mostly they're open during school hours and oftentimes have referrals to other healthcare centers when school is not in session or during summer as well. Some operate during those times. So school-based health centers are vital safety net providers, often providing secondary prevention and ensuring that care is available to those who need it at affordable rates. Some of the primary health care services include checkups, physicals, well child visits, lab tests, and counseling to help manage chronic diseases. Some of the behavioral health services, broadly speaking, include screenings, risk assessments, small group counseling, interventions for mental health and emotional issues. And some of the health education initiatives which school-based health centers undertake include both individual and small group interventions on things like nutrition, physical activity, healthy relationships, and much more. As you can see, and by the show of hands in the room, you know that the existence of a school-based health center is both critical and innovative. It's a really wonderful model to bring healthcare to the students that need it, where they are, and in their school. In addition to expanded access to healthcare and the resulting improved health outcomes, such as decreased emergency room visits and reduced hospital admission rates, there is preliminary evidence that we're aiming to build a stronger case that schools with school-based health centers have better academic outcomes and such as reduced chronic absenteeism, increased seat time, decreased discipline rates, etc. Students who don't feel well have a harder time learning. We know that, and we know that learning and health are intimately linked. So school-based health centers provide a positive benefit for the families because they're able to send their kids to receive the health care that they need without potentially missing crucial time at their own jobs. And as we said before, it's a really wonderful opportunity to bring education and health together. Early interventions such as school-based health centers really can drive improved health and success for a student and their family. So as I mentioned, I work at the School-Based Health Alliance. We are a small nonprofit that's based in DC, and we serve as the national voice and focus for 2,300 school-based health centers. 2,300. Everyone in this room who raised their hand is knowledgeable about school-based health centers. It's sort of a new area for me, and I didn't really understand how pervasive these crucial centers were and how many existed, basically. But our vision at the School-Based Health Alliance is that all children and adolescents are healthy and achieving at their fullest potential, both academically and health. We work closely with affiliates in 19 states to represent the school-based health centers at the local and state level. We have individual and organizational members, and through all of our work, we strive to help the school-based health centers provide the best possible clinical care and to operate effectively so that they're sustainable from the business perspective as well. Thank you for the demo. We also provide technical assistance to school-based health centers on all kinds of issues. So if a school-based health center is looking at Medicaid billing, we might offer technical assistance to them on being able to do that, or to, as we're going to hear from two of our initiatives, to work closely with other organizational partners, such as community-based organizations, other health organizations in the community, and within the school itself. One of the ways we like to advance and uplift the work of school-based health centers is through our learning collaboratives or learning labs. These are really, really cool projects, which are structured ways to engage with highly committed practitioners in school-based health centers from around the country and throughout those 2,300 sites. The folks who are a part of these learning collaboratives commit to piloting really new and innovative approaches, experimenting with new models of care delivery, and conducting outreach and engagement beyond the clinic walls. Each collaborative convenes virtually as well as in person to share what they learn from each other. And we at the School-Based Health Alliance share these lessons of each learning collaborative with the field. Two of the initiatives which we'll be highlighting here are the New Directions Initiative and the Hallways to Health Initiative. Just to learn a little bit more about each of those projects, because you're going to hear a snippet of what one or two sites in each of those learning collaboratives has done. The New Directions Initiative, which Sheila and Addie will be speaking on, is a school-based health grant funded by CVS Caremark Charitable Trust and administered by us at the School-Based Health Alliance. It aims to build the capacity of school-based healthcare field through policy and practice solutions. Some of the grantees are aiming to improve access to healthcare services for children and create system-level changes. These system-level changes elevate the role of the school-based health centers in being able to achieve population-level outcomes. The four focus areas for the initiative are the patient-centered medical home model, sustainability, public health, and parent engagement. So all across the board, and there's some really cool stuff that you'll hear about in a few moments. And the Hallways to Health Initiative is a school-based health alliance launched initiative with support from Kaiser Permanente and their Thriving Schools grant. We wanted to test how we could change a school's landscape using the school-based health center as the catalyst. And the concept is that health should spill out from the school-based health center into a school's hallways, classrooms, cafeteria, teacher's lounge, and neighborhood. And to do that, the Learning Collaborative is focusing on three issues: healthy eating, active living, school employee wellness, and social emotional health. So our speakers will focus on social emotional health and the wonderful innovations which these learning collaboratives have piloted. So some of the themes and best practices for expanding school-based health centers as a safety net, and their approaches to managing social emotional health and at-risk students. There are a few themes that you'll hear through each of these presenters' discussions. The first is identification of needs for high-risk students. So in order to be able to design an intervention that is relevant for specific populations, we need to identify the needs first. So through screening at the clinic level and data collection at the clinic, as well as examination of public school records and discipline records, each of these fine panelists will discuss how they identified the needs for their students and have focused on high-risk students for their interventions. Their interventions are designed specifically to meet these needs. That includes sharing data, coordinating plans and coordinating care for students, and restructuring things like discipline policies and procedures. One of the other major themes that you'll hear from these presenters is partnership. All of this innovation could not occur without strategic partnership. So it is crucial that all the different key stakeholders who touch a student's life are involved in these interventions in order to make them successful. That includes youth, either not only being a target of the intervention, but having a voice in designing the intervention and talking about what's relevant and specific to them. The school staff, because these interventions are happening in the school building, and they have a relationship with the school-based health center and can make it a success or a failure. That includes administrators as well. And the last key partner is the community organizations, which help to also provide these vital safety net supports. That's just my quick references. And now I would like to introduce Tammy Alexander.
Thank you, Jordana. Okay, I want to know specifically who works in a school-based health center. Okay, cool. That helps me narrow it down a little bit. So, good morning. Greetings from Oregon. I am Tammy Alexander. I work for the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. I am a state affiliate of the national organization that Jordana mentioned, and I hope I do this right. There we go. I have no relationships to disclose. Excuse me. And today, we're going to just, like Jordana said, we're just going to take a snippet or a snapshot of some of the projects that we've been involved in Hallways to Health, and we're going to learn about three little programs that were implemented in our Hallways to Health program in Oregon and Washington that really helped move the needle on social and emotional health for the students. And then at the end of that, I'm just going to talk about, it says, three lessons learned, but I have a few more than three. So, anyway. So basically, the Hallways to Health initiative really wanted to equip the school-based health centers to do something that they're not traditionally known of doing, and that is stepping beyond their clinical walls and going into the role of, as it was first outlined, obesity prevention, and now we call it active living, healthy eating, social emotional health, and employee wellness. Now, the school-based health centers could not simply do this by themselves. They could be the catalyst, they could be the cheerleader, they could be the convener, they could, you know, be all those kind of things, but they couldn't do it alone, simply by time and resources, could not do it, and so it has to be done in partnerships, as was mentioned. But the partnership piece is very critical, because if you imagine a school-based health center who is a health entity, sort of a guest within a school, has its own culture, its own way that they speak and they talk, and then you're in an education setting, they have their own culture, their own language, their own way that they deal. And so to ask these school-based health centers to go beyond the clinical walls, their traditional way of operating, they really need to engage the partners that interface the educational landscape in order to make the work successful. And so it just simply could not be done alone without partnerships. Oh, you know what? I'm going to go back. How do I go back? Or just ignore that slide. Just ignore it. Okay. I want to give you a little bit more foundation about hallways to health, just adding on to what Jordana said. So a few years ago, School-Based Health Alliance and Kaiser Permanente came together and they said, you know, let's form a partnership. We have this thriving Thrive initiative. We have this thriving communities. We have this thriving school kind of initiative, but we need more structure. You know, it's organic sort of based kind of thing, but let's partner together and see how we can make this Thrive initiative work in the schools. And they joined with the school-based health centers to make that work. The Hallways to Health initiative, I call it H2H, is in 5 states: Maryland, Georgia, California, Washington, and Oregon. 15 sites, and as Jordana said, it's from, you know, elementary up to high school. I have 4 sites, 3 in Oregon, 1 in Washington, and we really set out to see how, in a learning collaborative style, based upon each site's organic needs, how could they move the needle a little bit in these areas around policy, system change, environment, and even clinical change. And so each of the 15 sites came together, assessed their needs, and then developed a plan. And for 2 years, we implemented based upon the needs of each community and did some evaluation and some adjustments along the way. And at the end of our 2 years, you know, we had some fairly significant outcomes. We are in phase 2 of Hallways to Health now, where we're going to be focusing more on how do we affect the population broader than we did before in a more intentional way, and that will be part 2 of this discussion today, so I won't go much into that, but I will be looking back at the first 2 years that we did Hallways to Health. So I'm going to touch base very quickly on 3 different programs that were done in our Oregon, Washington sites. One is Kind to All. It's an anti-bullying program via a pro-respect approach. So we're trying to tell them what to do instead of what not to do. It would be really easy if we could just say, oh, stay strong and stop bullying and, you know, let's just do this, but it doesn't work that way. So I'll tell you briefly about that. Healthy relationships groups, what was done in that area for a male and a female healthy relationship groups, and then a stress relief student-led initiative. So let's just touch base on Kind to All. So this program grew out of a Seattle detective's observations, what he saw as being a school resource officer, of being in the, you know, a detective in Seattle, that there was bullying programs that focused a lot on the bully itself and identifying the kids at risk for bullying and stuff like that, some on the victim or whatever. But he wanted to create more of a cultural change, and so he developed this initiative called Kind to All. And it's basically creating a sea of respect. So the S stands for self, understanding yourself and where you fit into the world. Earth is being respectful of Earth, and in the global sense, but also in the community sense of your school and where you fit in the school. And then A stands for action. And so in how it was implemented in Washington Middle School in Seattle was basically they had the original police detective that started the program come in, and he did a training of 60 kids and made them ambassadors of respect. And they would go out and they had little rubber, you know, bands that said Kind to All, and they had extra ones, and they would hand them out when they saw people doing kind things and respectful things and more appropriate behaviors. And then there were posters, and there were, you know, some, you know, discussions in class. So where there was just this ripple effect of we're trying to create respect in our world, not going, oh, you can't be a bully and rah, rah, and identifying the bad kids per se, but really trying to find a way to put out the norm is being kind and respectful. And so they did that the last half of the first year, and then the second half, the second year, they did it again, trained more kids, had some tabling at lunches, and it became, you know, it became okay. I mean, we're talking middle school here, folks, so it became okay to hand out a bracelet. They wore T-shirts. More ambassadors were brought on board, and it was, you know, hoping to create a sea of change. And it can be tailored. It's not a set curriculum. It's what you do for your community, and the cost is only basically, you know, the bands, or if you want T-shirts or whatever, and you can just be taught how to do this very simply, and it's very organic for your community. This year, they're going to implement it in all the incoming sixth graders, so they're all going to get trained in Kind to All. That's going on right now, and as those sixth graders morph into seventh graders, hopefully they'll do some follow-up and some, you know, supercharging of the whole initiative, and it'll continue to grow, and the next batch of sixth graders will be taught. And this is affecting a cultural change within this middle school. The Healthy Relationship Groups, this was also done at Washington Middle School. There were two different groups. There was a male group and there was a female group. The male group was led by a University of Washington student, co-led with one of the mental health people. And they identified these young men through the school-based health center as at risk due to some of the history that they collected in their risk assessments. And so they were invited into this group, and they met weekly for a whole year. And these young men stayed in this group. And basically, Futures Without Violence, you can go to that website, and I have the information at the end of the presentation to where to get this information. It's not a set curriculum. It's not you do chapter one first, chapter two, chapter three. It's pull down these topics depending upon what the needs of your group are and work with these young men to help them understand as they develop into, you know, maybe dating relationships, what is real appropriate normative behavior. Not maybe what the norm is in their family or their neighborhood or their school or what they see on TV, but what does a healthy relationship look like? How do you act? Pro-social skill development, you know, it just gives them the foundation. And so hopefully they're not having to be intervened on later on because they're in an abusive relationship or acting out in their relationships. So it's hopefully laying that foundation. The Expect Respect curriculum comes out of Austin, Texas. It's been around for a while also. This was a group of ladies that met every other week after school from March to June, and they must have liked it too because they kept coming back every other week. And again, it wasn't a set curriculum where you go from chapter one to chapter five. You pull down the topics that are necessary based upon the needs of your group. And so what they are invested in it, they suggest the topics, you're responsive, you get the information for them, and again, hopefully laying down the foundations of what you should expect in a relationship as you go into your later adolescent years and giving them appropriate normative expectations. The boys group had 20 consistent attenders and the girls group had 12. We're waiting for the evaluation on the Futures Without Violence Young Men's Group, and there was no, there's just a process evaluation done in the Expect Respect curriculum, and they're going to try to establish that in a different way this year so they can have a better evaluation of that process. But this is the cool one here. Although the other two were cool too, but this was incredible. So we had a school-based health center that was only 2 years old. And this school-based health center is in Milwaukee, Oregon. And they were founded based upon a very lengthy community engagement process based upon one champion in the school, a vice principal, said, you know, I heard about school-based health centers. What is this thing? And so he went and he visited a few and he said, we need one. And so he brought community people together, parents together, district people together, potential medical sponsors together, and he started having them meet like twice a month for like 4 years. 4 years. Because there was no money available at that point, but there was a vision, there was a need, and there was investment by education and the medical field to make this happen. So when money became available, they were able to get a planning grant from the state, they were able to pull down money from the federal capital improvement, and they built a beautiful clinic. So we have a school-based health center. It's only 2 years old. It's, you know, it's still ramping up, getting the students in the door. But it was based upon community engagement. And so when Hallways to Health came along, they had partners that were used to being asked to come and plan. And so they were asked to come and plan around Hallways to Health. And what is this Hallways to Health? Well, we want to do this, 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 this. And so over 25 people showed up for a full-day retreat, including, you know, educational administration, including partnerships, including the medical sponsor, including youth representatives from the Youth Advisory Council that they have. And they came together and they said, what do we need to do? What are the needs here? And the kids said, you know what? Beyond a doubt, every kid in the school, doesn't matter if you're a star athlete, if you're a super achiever academic, if you're just barely getting by, everyone is affected by stress. And it keeps some kids from coming to school. It keeps kids from being present in their classroom. It really affects us. We want to do something about stress. And so they were set forth to say, okay, let's design this. So they came together, and I just want to show you a picture, give you a break from the words up on the screen. The picture on your left is a sampling of the 60 kids that came together and identified what the challenges were and identified some presentations around it, and then they set out to, with administration support, to give presentations in every study hall throughout the day. They gave presentations to all the teachers, and then they did a tabling, a picture on the right, at a lunch where youth were encouraged to come by and say, hey, yeah, I have stress. I heard about this, you know, stress relief kind of thing, and I'm going to commit to a coping skill. And so just a tiny measurable coping skill. I commit to breathing 100 breaths every day. I commit to talking to someone about my whatever. I commit to doing something. I commit to coping. And so then they made a little art project, and they wrote it down, and they, you know, accountability. And they posted it up on a mural. And this is at a very important intersection in their school where over 130 teachers and students committed to coping. And they gave examples of how they're going to do that. And it was very powerful because it was student-identified, student-led, and student follow-up. And that's very critical in any initiative, is that we provide youth an opportunity to be intentionally and appropriately engaged. So some of the lessons, and I'm going to go over more than three. So partnerships make the difference. School-based health centers, this little entity in a school, cannot do this by themselves. They have to get out of the clinic walls, and I loved it how Jordana said they have to, you know, go down the halls, they have to get into the classrooms, they have to get into the administration, they have to get into the community, and they lead the effort, but they don't do it all. They cannot do it all. They don't have the time and resources to do it all, but they are certainly experts in this area. Second lesson learned is change. It's all about relationships. You can't go out there by yourself and affect change, and it's going to take time. One school, it took them a whole year working with their nutrition services department to get permission to do a food class in the cafeteria after school. It took a whole year to get that permission done because they had to establish relationships with them, had to trust, and then bring in the food bank, and it took a whole year to do that. And you think, oh, well, that's no big deal. Let's just go out some classes in the cafeteria. Sometimes it is a very big deal. And again, I've talked about the youth. We need their perspective. We need their leadership. And it is done in a very respectful way where they're intentionally brought to the table and they're not just a token. They're not just added to a committee, that they are part of and they're valued and they're taken care of. Some of these youth are not your typical leaders, and that's great. We need kids from all, you know, circumstances to be in this leadership role. We need to encourage them, we need to support them, and we need to help them figure out how to be a leader. And then one of the most vital things with the healthcare entity is that you need to know that that school calendar is sacred. So when you think that you can just ask for this or 20 minutes in a staff meeting, or how about we have a health fair here, or what do we do here? It takes so much ramp time to get that to happen. And you need to understand that the schools are maxed out in their, you know, calendar already with testing and, you know, school days of seat time and everything else. And so if you're going to add anything into it and pull away from what they've already got scheduled, it takes time to make that happen. You may start the planning this year, but it won't happen until the next calendar year. It's that important for the educational calendar to be structured. Don't be surprised if you go to your school partners and say you want something to happen and it takes a while. Non-billable services. The clinics survive a lot on billable services, but we need support for non-billable services. We need support for that nurse practitioner to go into the classrooms and to lead different classes. We need support for the mental health person to take time out of, you know, groups or one-on-ones to be able to do something with maybe a community gathering to talk to them about different topics. We need support and time for those. Another thing that really surprised me is school-based health centers. Since I've been around the school-based health center field for 20 some years, is that school-based health centers have gotten away from marketing themselves unless they're new. And so they need support to do basic outreach. They're often left alone by themselves as this little entity. In fact, in Oregon, when we first put school-based health centers into place in 85, we wanted them to be hidden. We wanted them to be underground and under the radar. Because if they weren't under the radar, they were attacked. And so it took a while to say, come on out, it's okay. You can talk about who you are and what you do. And so I was surprised to find out that most school-based health centers don't even do any kind of formal marketing outreach, and you need to do that. And then, time, it's all about process and eventually outcomes. And your outcomes may be small, they may be gradual, they may be, you know, tiny steps in the right direction, but that's what we want to do. We want to move that needle in the right direction. And then, of course, food. Always have food. Make sure it's healthy. And then I know that one of my sites said, and a little bit of dancing always helps too. Mm-hmm. So those are my lessons learned. Here's some information for you. I put in Mandy LeBlanc at the bottom. She is the person that led two of the initiatives I talked about, the Be Kind to All program and the relationship groups. And so if you have more specific questions that I can't answer later on, Mandy certainly be very happy to help you out and lead you in the right direction. And I think that's it.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us for this first session of the second day of the conference. My name is Shelia McCann. I am the Senior Director for Strategic Clinical Programs with Health Choice Network of Florida. We're based in Miami, where it's supposed to be in the mid-80s today and sunshiny. So I just carry that thought with you. So today, what I will be doing is describing to you a project that we started last year and are currently working on through this year as well. The only disclosure I have is that our program, our project, was funded through a grant from the School-Based Health Alliance. Other than that, we're clean. Learning objectives for this morning, we're going to describe the process and resources that we use to identify and treat psychosocial needs of school children where we use integrated data systems. We also will discuss the outcomes of employing our algorithm that we developed to connect high-risk students, and these are students at high risk for failing in school, to community partners for additional behavioral health services. So our project is a data-driven approach to identify students before they fail. And the reason it's a data-driven approach is really becomes kind of evident when I describe a little bit about who we are and how we came to be. So Health Choice Network of Florida is a health center controlled network which means that our board of directors consists of primarily chief executive officers of community health centers, primarily federally qualified health centers from across the state of Florida. Our members provide primary behavioral and mental health services to throughout the state. Our project had three partners. The Jesse Trice Community Health Center has been in existence for about 48 years. They have they serve about 32,800 patients with 111,000 annual visits. So they're very significant presence in the community that they serve. Our second partner is the Miami Children's Initiative, which is 9 years old. It's a community-based organization serving specifically Community Liberty City. They are implementing the Harlem Children's Zone approach to provide a block-by-block comprehensive needs identification, resource identification, and solution-driven activities really designed around children from birth through college to career. Anybody here who's ever heard of the Harlem Children's Zone knows of its incredible impact beginning in Harlem, and there are efforts around the country. I believe it's become a national model, and so there are funded efforts to really introduce it in similar communities. Our third partner, of course, is the Miami-Dade Public Schools District. The Miami-Dade Public Schools District is the fourth largest in the country, serving 345,000 students in 392 schools, it's quite extensive. Health Choice Network has been around for 20 years. It began with five community health centers in Miami, Florida, who came together out of a desire to see how they could pool resources for purchasing and implementation of health technology. Today, we are, again, statewide. We have approximately 23 members in the state, and our primary business service is health information technology. The projects that I work with all provide services through the community health centers, all with the objective of improving quality of healthcare and center operations. So we are really in one neighborhood, Liberty City in Miami. It is one of the oldest historically African-American communities in Miami. It's approximately 5,395 square miles with 163,000 residents. So you can see that it is a fairly intense, densely populated community. The average, I'm going to tell you a little bit about it from a demographic perspective because I think it's important to have an understanding of the environment in which these students, these children are living and its impact on their school experience. So the median income is approximately $22,000. 51% of the population has some or no high school experience. 50% have never married. 47% are living below the federal poverty income level. And if you look at the some of the measures of crime in communities such as assault, robbery, auto theft, personal crime, property-based crime, Liberty City exceeds the national average in all of these areas. One recent story with Miami Children's Initiative this past July 4th weekend, they lost a 18-year-old volunteer young man who had been working with them for a couple of years in a lot of their activities and initiatives in the neighborhood when he was gunned down as a just not I won't say accidental, because he was not the target, but he was caught in the middle of something else that was going on between other parties. So he lost his life. So that is, unfortunately, not an uncommon occurrence in Liberty City. So that's the environment that we're working in, and you now know a little bit about the three primary partners that have come together to look at students, to give them a better outlook, better try to improve their academic performance in school. So a data-driven model. We can all say, okay, given statistics that I just described about Liberty City, you can sit there and say, as we did, well, we all know why these students are having challenges. I mean, they're just confronted by issues and challenges every day, every hour, from every single perspective that one can understand, and some of us cannot understand. But we said, well, it's one thing to sort of like know it, but it's another thing to be able to document and prove and really use data constructively to help identify students who are most at risk for school performance failure, and to identify interventions that will assist them towards a very different outcome. So Health Choice Network of Florida has a database system that we call CHEER. I always have to write that down, because we call it CHEER all the time, and honestly, if it's not written down, I could not tell you what it is. And CHEER primarily is a feed that we receive every day from the Miami-Dade Public Schools system. The feed is for every child in the system, identifies what school they're in, and we use it to support the school-based health initiatives that our member centers, and as well as other participating organizations in Miami-Dade County, have. Children's Trust in Miami-Dade County provides funds to set up and staff school-based health units in schools, about 89 schools throughout the county. This year we have four community health centers who are members of our network, who are providing services through that funded program. So in our particular project, we're utilizing the data that we get on this feed from the Miami-Dade Public Schools, along with information that is entered directly from these school-based health units in the schools, so that the data available in CHEER that is used daily in our school-based health offices, services, really supports the initiative. So the question that we were asking ourselves with our project is, can data identify students most at risk for school performance failure? And so we looked at what would be some of the elements in creating an algorithm, if you will, that we could run against that data and identify students who are candidates or eligible for interventions. We know that we had excused and unexcused absences. We have the Florida statewide testing scores for each student. We also could identify a student who is eligible or participating in the free reduced lunch program. We know what school grade they're in. We had some very basic elements about that student. So we said, well, not every student who misses a lot of school is necessarily a low performer. There could be a medical reason for that. We have in Miami-Dade families who are very transient. We have families that move in and out of the country on a fairly regular basis and are gone for months at a time. But when they bring those kids back into the country, they go right back to school. So we basically have some kids who are attending school in two different countries, attending two different school systems. But that doesn't mean that they're failing when they're here in the United States or in the Miami public schools. So we said, let's look at performance on the Florida statewide test to see how valuable that is. So we looked at different score levels, and we determined to use less than two, a score of two or one, basically, which clearly means that this is a student who is struggling, at least in mastering the elements that are being tested on a statewide basis. And these elements are used across the state to as an indicator of how well a student is performing in school. And they're also looked at in the context of how well that school is performing. And of course, we wanted to use a fairly commonly used measure of poverty, which is eligibility or participation in the free reduced lunch program. So this is the algorithm that we decided to use. So we ran that against our database, and we also realized that we had another challenge in how to very safely provide information to identify students to our partners and really stick to the requirements for confidentiality of information. So our student referral flow actually incorporates all of the partners. We identify the students by running our algorithm against the CHEER database. We give the list to the school nurse, who then delivers the list to the school principal, and it is the school principal who then refers the students to Miami Children's Initiative. At the Miami Children's Initiative, we have a staff, including a licensed clinical social worker, who assesses the child, and then the staff identifies resources available to assist the child with the need. So in Miami Children's Initiative has pulled together what I call a curated network of service support providers to assist the students. And last year we had 25 community-based service providers, and these included agencies of the county as well as other nonprofit organizations. This year, we formalized the process somewhat so that providers needed to actually commit in writing to really create like memos of understanding and agreement. And so we have 18 formal community-based services agreements in place. One of the most important is with AGAPE, which is a behavioral and mental health center that is part of our network. And the importance of AGAPE is that it provides home-based behavioral health services to children and their families. So our list identified last year 350 students. What we noticed almost immediately is that 67% of these students were in one school, Brownsville Middle School. Brownsville had 811 students, 82% used the school health suite as their health resource, even though their primary medical care may have been provided through other providers, but 82% used that school health service at least once during the school year. They average 13 visits a day, so they're very busy. And 97% of the students in this school are eligible or participating in the free reduced lunch program. I thought, well, okay, so what else do we know about this school? We know that this school has a history of not doing well in the school grading that's used every year by the Miami-Dade Public Schools to kind of say how well the school students in the school are performing overall. The grades are from A to F. And as you can see, Brownsville has a history of low performance. Also to note, Brownsville has had a new principal every year, and sometimes a new principal during the school year. From the end of last school year to this school year, we also have a new principal there. So part of the engagement for Miami Children's Initiative is to engage these principals every single time because the principal is plays a critical role in the referral process. So out of the 350, we were able to successfully refer 155 students for support services. Now, this is kind of interesting. You can say, well, you only hit half. Again, remember, the community we're in is not a community that responds necessarily well to offers of intervention. It takes a lot to get one student and the family referred into an organization for support services. It's not a question of contacting the parents or guardians of the student and saying, hey, we'd like to talk to you about some additional services that may be important. No, it's like a, hey, hang up. And that happens multiple times. The beauty of working with an organization like Miami Children's Initiative is that they are in that community. They're in that community every day on a block-by-block basis. And over time, the staff has become very well-known and accepted within the community. So of those 155 students who were referred, about three were referred to law enforcement when we identified some abuse, sexual and physical abuse in the home. Most of the students were referred for tutoring. We also had students who were referred for mental health services. And this is where Jesse Trice also plays a very important role. The Community Health Center, we were able to refer students there for services. We had students who were able to come a long way. Some of the problems that we identified, and I just have a couple of quick stories to share with you. We had one student who had a great deal of absenteeism. We discovered that the family was living in one room of a house, and the house was in foreclosure. There was another family there. So the intervention consisted of finding more appropriate housing for the family and eventually employment services for the father of the family. Interestingly, the mother of that family had recently passed away. So there was just a tremendous amount of trauma in the family. The Brownsville principal last year was able to identify a space in the school for the licensed clinical social worker with Agape, who was able to decorate the room and was able to provide services to students on site, which became immensely valuable in helping to address the needs. We had another student who had been suspended from school and was actually in the street. And we found out that he had not told his mother that he had been suspended from school, and she did not want him at home alone. So MCI intervened with the mother. They were able to make some alternative arrangements for the student with the school so that the student was able to satisfactorily complete his suspension and return to school full time. And with added support, the student has been attending school full time and staying out of trouble. So what did we learn? We've learned that the FCAT doesn't tell the whole story. And so MCI has made arrangements with the parents when the students are engaged this year so that we're getting the report cards and tracking actual grades of the students so we can more specifically pinpoint areas of opportunity. We also learned that it was critical to formalize that community services network, which we did do. So yes, the algorithm works. We were able to identify 355 really high-risk students. We provided services to 150 of them, 23 of whom received behavioral health counseling services that they would not have had. And we've had some very good outcomes for those students. Interestingly, this year, the Miami-Dade Public School System did not load last year's statewide testing scores. We had some experiences in the state last year where there were computer failures and software failures in the school, and our superintendent was quite vocal in his dissatisfaction and did not load the scores. So the grades for us are becoming even more critical as we move forward. So yes, our algorithm says that with the data, you can use the data but it requires a collaborative network of resources that have been coordinated services to the student and the family. And we, at the end of this year, we will be tracking educational and school attendance improvement for the kids that were identified last year. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Celia. Next up is Addie Van Swell.
Good morning, everybody. As Jordana said, my name is Addie Van Swell, and I work for Loyola University Chicago. We have a school-based health center in Maywood, Illinois, which is about 10 miles west of the city. So Maywood, the school health center has been there for about 13 years. And just as far as student demographics, we're about 55% African American, 41% Latino. So just kind of keep that in mind as I describe this program. So I don't have any specific relationships to disclose. I do have a number of acknowledgments. I'm not going to read through them all. But these are a lot of our different funding sources, and we were a part of the New Directions grant as well. So I'm going to try to get through all of these objectives, but basically what I'm going to be focusing on is explaining how school-based health centers can integrate social-emotional learning into an in-school suspension classroom setting, discuss potential barriers, and there were a lot of them, in school districts, and how you can overcome these, and then also identify ways in which this can be replicated in other schools. So I wanted to start off pretty basic. So what is in-school suspension? It's a disciplinary consequence for violations of the student code of conduct. It's typically a classroom or a designated area in the school for students who are sent there or assigned there for their misbehavior. But the programs really vary greatly across the U.S. I've heard of some in-school spaces just being by security. So there's not actually even a room, it's just go sit by the security guard and they're going to babysit you. In the school that I'm in, it actually is a separate dedicated classroom. Typically, in-school suspension can be a combination of things, but typically a lot of schools use it as a punitive measure. There's other schools that use it for more academic support. Also, it can be therapeutic or a combination of all of that. So the most effective in-school suspension programs have ways to ensure that it's the appropriate consequence. So for example, there's been research that has shown that if you address tardies or absences in in-school suspension, that it doesn't actually change the behavior, because oftentimes tardies and absences there's an underlying issue for that. And so oftentimes in-school suspension programs don't even get to the tip of the iceberg in addressing those truancy related issues. Also, if you put a cap on the number of students or a number of days in the in-school suspension room, that can be effective. Having problem solving skills, mediation among teachers and students, it can also provide as a contract for future expectations. So explaining to the student that, hey, you did this time, but next time we're expecting to see a change in your behavior. And then staffed by both a teacher who can identify unidentified learning issues and a counselor who can actually talk to the kids and figure out what's really going on, which led to their misbehavior. So before I get into the real program and what that really is, I want to give a story of the 2013-2014 school year where I was playing a little bit with the in-school suspension classroom. I did a lot of observation. I saw it as being used as a very punitive consequence for the students, and I was going in there every once in a while. I would go talk to the kids, figure out what was going on. I was trying to build some skills, trying to really get down to some of the root causes. And one day I went in there, and there were two students, and they'd known me because they'd seen me in there before. The one student was not a particular fan of mine. The other student really enjoyed me. So as I walk in, the student didn't want to be bothered with me, and he was like, you need to go away. And I was like, well, I'm not going to go. Like, I'm going to be here. I'm going to talk to you guys. And the other student that really had liked me, he was like, you're really like that thing. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, you know, that thing that doesn't go away. And I was like, I have no idea. Like, this could go anywhere. I have no idea what you're talking about. And he was like, herpes. You're like herpes. You never go away. And I'm like, huh. I don't really know how to respond to that. But it really did kind of fuel my energy and my inspiration to formalize a program in the in-school suspension classroom. So then the New Directions grant came around, and we were selected to participate. So this is a public health initiative, and it was created, developed, and implemented during the 2014-2015 school year. And I collaborated with the deans of students, the in-school suspension teacher, and there's also a teacher assistant in the classroom. And so I was really trying, kind of going back to what's been said before about collaboration, collaborate with the people that I was working with to try to make it the most successful program. So if it wasn't for him calling me herpes, I may have never done this. Okay, so real education about life is, there's a few different components of it. So the first component is that the students, anytime they're referred to in-school suspension, they complete a processing form. Prior to this program, they were essentially just placed there, said, hey, you gotta go sit in school, and there was no discussion around behavior, consequences, future actions. It was just like, hey, go sit in there and maybe you'll get your homework. So I completed this referral form for them to really identify the issue that got them in there, what they were thinking, feeling, doing, what they could do differently next time. And I think this has really helped students actually think about their behaviors. There's also a component of social-emotional classroom-based discussion, so I'll go into that a little bit in the future slides. But it gives the students access to me as the social worker for the school-based health center daily, and then outside of the in-school suspension room, they then know who I am, I'm a familiar face, they're more comfortable to come see me in the clinic, and it also kind of expands the access to our medical providers as well. So this is the in-school suspension reflection form that I had created. And there's typically three responses that I have in looking these forms over. So the first line of contact to review this form is actually the in-school suspension classroom teacher, who has changed every year for the last 3 years. So every year there's a new teacher in there. Fortunately, it is a special education teacher, so she does have kind of an idea of different behaviors and can assess students for maybe unidentified learning disabilities. I have her kind of categorize or rate the forms as she reviews them. So if it's a pretty normal response, like let's say the student got kicked out of class and they said, yeah, I was just laughing and I wasn't really thinking anything, I was feeling okay, I wanted to get out of class, and yeah, I got what I wanted, and yeah, I'm not really going to do anything different, maybe I'll try to not laugh in class next time. That's a pretty typical response, I don't see a whole lot of need for intervention there. There's another one, like a concerning response, so that's kind of the level two of where maybe they were under the influence of drugs or alcohol and they were in class, but then they left class, went to go smoke some weed behind the bleachers, and then they came back in the building, now they're high, and then they got caught. So that would be, the in-school teacher typically talks to them about that, but then also puts that aside for me to do further intervention. And then there've been other times where follow-up is absolutely necessary. So when I've had a student who identified on the form that they were feeling depressed or they were feeling like it wasn't worth living anymore, those are immediate interventions that I then had to go to the in-school room and pull that student in process and develop a plan. So those were the kind of the three areas or levels that I have the in-school teacher kind of rate each form, and then I go back through and read through them all anyway, just to make sure that there wasn't anything that she missed. So the most common referrals for in-school suspension are actually in the middle. So the tardies, absences, failure to serve their detentions, their Saturday schools, dress code. We do have a school uniform. They didn't really enforce it last year until probably January. And so then all these students were getting sent to in-school suspension because they weren't in uniform, but it was really nothing that they were consistently enforcing. Or if they were off campus or down in the basement where they weren't supposed to be. The other issues that I saw often were verbal or physical altercations, being kicked out of class. By the end of the school year, I knew exactly which teachers. The students didn't even have to tell me anymore. They're like, I'm like, what class? And they're like, oh, is this class? I'm like, yeah, I don't know why I asked, because I knew. Because we'd hear the same teachers' names over and over and over again. There's also, they had put students in there who didn't have an ID, or if they were late to lunch. So some of these reasons are a little more ridiculous than others, but they're definitely, some of them can be reasons for intervention. So as far as my daily classroom sessions, I focused on five main areas. So on Mondays, we talk about relationships. Tuesdays, we talk about anger. Wednesdays, we talk about substance use and abuse. Thursdays, life skills. And Fridays, stress management. So it happens frequently that we'll be talking about relationships, but then other issues come up. So they kind of, each topic is set for each day, but, you know, if we're talking about relationships and then it somehow gets into stress, or we're talking about anger and then we start talking about, well, if they would just leave me alone, then I wouldn't have any problems. So then we get back into the relationship discussion. So it's all very fluid. And so even though each day is a different topic, it often overlaps. One of the things that I would like to point out about this is that I've used different curriculums, different workbooks. I try to get the students more engaged because they're stuck there. The only time they're able to talk is actually when I'm in the classroom. So I try to get them engaged in a discussion. I've tried to have them do role plays, just anything to get them up, active, out of their seats, but also learning something new. So this is just from our year one of the program results. So essentially what we were trying to do is we were trying to keep the students in school. So I don't want them out of school suspensions. I don't really want them in-school suspension. But if you're going to suspend a kid, I'd rather have them be in school. So at the final point in our reporting, I had seen 350 different kids in the in-school suspension classroom. That was last school year. This school year, it's been a little bit different. But I had about 125 sessions with them. And what I would like to point out is the third question down where it says, does the number of referrals to in-school suspensions decrease after program implementation? I think this is a really hard question to answer. And especially with just a one-year kind of implementation of the program. It also, how can I put it? I think that it is a positive intervention for the school, but we're working with the school with, who's kind of reverted back to zero tolerance policies in some ways. Towards the end of last school year, the principal started kicking students out for 10 days at a time for fights. And so that really kind of hampered both this in-school suspension program and also another after-school program that I do, because he wanted to have control of the building. He felt like having control of the building was suspending the kids. This year we have a new principal, which is refreshing, and he is definitely doing everything that he can to kind of change some of those policies. So there were many, many challenges. I think I boiled them down into four different categories. So inconsistency, so this can mean a lot of different things. So inconsistency in the number of days that a student was referred to in-school suspension. So I can have a kid in there for one class period. I could have a kid in there for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. There was this one student who had been there for weeks because there was a safety issue, and I'm like, there's got to be a better way to integrate this kid back into the classroom while keeping him safe. But that's a whole other story. And then inconsistency around kind of the, and I guess it goes to staff a little bit, but there would be different people in there all the time. So you may have the dedicated in-school suspension teacher getting pulled for IEP meetings almost frequently throughout the day. We would have substitute teachers in there who had no classroom management ability, so that was really hard to deal with that. As far as the daily routine of the classroom, oftentimes they have all these rules that are on the board, like you can't talk, you can't be on your phone, it's all the things you can't do, and almost every single time I was in there, all of those rules were being broken. And what was probably one of the most frustrating things for me is that when I was in there doing my social-emotional learning and really engaging the kids in conversations, if the teacher's assistant felt like they were being disrespectful or felt like they were acting up too much, he would then write them another referral. And I'm like, wait, no, stop. This defeats the entire purpose. So I would really do everything in my power to keep the kid in school or in the classroom, because I don't think it really served the purpose to send them back upstairs so then they can get an out-of-school suspension. So oftentimes I would kind of have these little, not arguments, but I would just say, hey, no, he's fine. Like, keep him here. He's not bothering me. Like, I'll reel him in, but please don't send him upstairs. There's also been student difficulties. So there were times where students just didn't engage or they were being very loud or rude or disrespectful. I didn't have that too much, but sometimes that did occur. Also, there was a, because of the inconsistency, they would put too many students in there. So at one point I was in there with 30 students. Well, that's not really productive. So I would go around to like little groups and try to do like mini sessions, but I'm like, this is not a very well-structured classroom environment. So there were a lot of different things that got in the way, but I did the best that I could to try to overcome those. So from a systematic standpoint, there are additional barriers. So I had alluded to kind of this thing of the school climate. So I've been at the school-based health center for, it'll be 5 years in February, and we are on principal number 3. We've had 2 assistant principals. And so right now our administration team is completely brand new. We have one person who's been there for just a year this October. So the school climate is slowly changing, and things, the teachers and everybody, it seems to be more positive. I'd mentioned the zero tolerance policies. The district has talked about bringing some restorative practices into the school. But they haven't successfully trained everybody, so that's a work in progress. The ongoing changes in administration. I am not employed by the school district, so I think this is a good thing and a bad thing. Mostly good. The students really don't see me as an outside person. I always identify myself as, I'm the Loyola social worker, I don't work for the district, you can tell me things, I'm not going to tell the school, that kind of thing. But I'm very well integrated into the school. So most of the teachers, the staff, the administration, they really see us and our health center as an integral part of the school. There's not a lot of research for in-school suspension programs. And there's also this idea of kind of billing issues and staff time. So this service that I'm providing, it's not billable. And it also takes a lot of time, so I'm usually in there at least one class period a day. So between the class period and the prep time, it does take time away from me seeing individual students or doing other things. So it can be, I think it can be used at all grade levels. It would obviously be a lot different for younger students. You're not going to have the same conversations about relationships with high schoolers that you would with, you know, fifth graders. So you would just have to adapt the kind of content of the curriculum. It can be used as I see it as a tier two intervention. And you can also kind of vary, kind of going back to the staffing issue, if you are not able to have somebody there for 5 days a week, you can decrease that. So maybe going 2 to 3 times a week instead of all 5 days. And the internet is a wonderful thing. There's a lot of really great free resources, workbooks, and that kind of thing. So if you need resources, the internet definitely has been helpful to me. So here are all my references, and I think that is all I have.
Thank you so much, Celia, Tammy, and Addie. We learned some wonderful things, as we said, about partnership and the time it takes to get the buy-in from all these key stakeholders, and identification of the correct community-based organization, and the challenges of even if you have buy-in in the school, the change in school administration, and how that adds constant challenges even once your intervention is already established to maintain and to fund these wonderful interventions. We also heard a lot about the coordination of care and provision by a lot of different entities, community-based organizations, school-based health centers, other individuals within the school to be able to make sure that these students have all of their needs taken care of, that the students' needs have been identified specifically for high-risk behaviors, and trying to get at the bottom of what is driving those high-risk behaviors, and trying to educate the students on empowerment and involve them in designing their own interventions and taking control of their own relationships and taking control of their own capacity to succeed. So thank you so much. I had some moderator questions, but I know that the room is full of school-based health center folks, so I wanted to give you the opportunity to stand up, introduce yourself, and direct your questions, not comments, to each of our panelists. So we have about 15 minutes to do that, and I will, I'll repeat your questions to just so that it's captured in the recording. Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Greenbaum. I'm from Advocate Health Services in Chicago. I have a question about the Miami Disease Project. I think we all realize that siloing data is no longer effective in driving health outcomes, but we meet a lot of challenges, and we're trying to share that data between school and healthcare platforms. What challenges do you meet, and how do you overcome those barriers?
So the question again, sorry, thank you, is about the use of data by multiple different parties, is that correct? And how to overcome that, especially thinking about something like electronic health records and sharing information between school and clinic and the complications that creates, is that correct? Great. Sheila, do you want to come up to the mic and answer?
Okay, I'll put a screen from here.
Okay.
Oh, do you have to be in the microphone for the recording?
Let's try it.
Unfortunately, it doesn't move.
No, I understand. So we had a couple of benefits. Number one, we already had the data coming in every day from the Miami-Dade Public School System. So we already had agreements in place with them around the data. We also had contract through the Children's Trust, which was already had an agreement with Miami-Dade Public Schools to collect information from the school-based health sites across the county, and that those agreements included the ability to utilize that data to improve services to students. We also, because Jesse Trice Community Health Center was contracted through us to provide school-based health services, that part of the circle had already been closed. The only element that we did not have in place was the community-based organization, Miami Children's Initiative. We subcontracted and did data agreements with that organization, as well as that organization had facilitated agreements with the principals in the schools so that the principals would refer the students to the Miami Children's Initiative. So we were able to break down those silos because we had agreements already in place with key parties, and we had to figure out how to add that additional piece for the community-based organization. We were able to do that through their existing relationships already in the community, and they were known to principals in the school, particularly at Brownsville Middle School. So they were able to negotiate that arrangement specifically with the principal of the school. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think those formal arrangements.
We had CHEER, the database system that serves as that aggregate. The feed from the Miami-Dade Public School Systems, part of it goes to CHEER. The school-based health system utilized CHEER already to collect data for services provided through the sites. And Miami Children's Initiative did not use CHEER, but we did bring in information around the services that the students were providing, the results of the referrals, the outcomes with the students. So that we brought in separately.
Thanks, Julia. I think we can take two or three more. Yeah. Question of the hour, how do we continue to fill and fund for these services which are crucial?
Go ahead, Tammy.
Okay.
I've got an anxious.
So having been in the field for 20 some years, it's going to differ state by state. It depends on sometimes just your base funding for education and for health, depending upon the direction you want to go. But where I see it going nationally is that we have to recognize that this intersection of health and education is the intersection we need to be going into. And until we can figure that out at a national level and a site-based level and in between, that's where we need to go. So we need to be, you know, documenting what we do, even if we don't get billed for it. We need to be advocating for looking at things like ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, because that's going to get the upstream social determinants kind of things. We need to really drive to common goals with education partners and health partners. I mean, that's sort of a big picture thing, and Leslie standing up in the back.
She's cheering you on back there.
So, Leslie, do you want to add something?
Thank you.
So it's going to be a multi-pronged approach depending upon your funding streams, but we need to look at our insurers, we need to look at our medical providers, our hospitals. We need to look at the variety of the landscape that looks at a kid and behavioral health, mental health too. We need to look at all those places where kids could be receiving help and where can they put money into the school. How can they do that? Because that's where the kids are, and that's where they're going to be identified, hopefully. And you need to be advocating at, you know, your site level, your state level, and the national level until we can get this intersection going better.
Questions, a follow-up question to the billing question. It's about the relationship between the school-based health centers and the state agencies and how to navigate some of the complex, often political avenues by which need to be navigated. Tammy's up again.
Oh my gosh. This is so complex, and again, it's based upon your state political pieces. So in Oregon, for example, we have had legislative support since the beginning, 1985, where we have put general funds into school-based health centers at a base level. Mind you, a base level. It won't run your school-based health center. But then that's our health piece. So we have bipartisan support that we have worked hard with the youth voice to get over the years to say school-based health centers is where it's at. Our Department of Ed is very different. I've worked across the United States, and I know that our Department of Ed is different because it's we have really site-based control of education. Besides the federal mandates, there's not a lot of state mandates. There's some state mandates, but no teeth. And so our Department of Education relationship is way different than many other places where the Department of Ed says what you're going to do all the way down to the site-based level. However, we do work closely with and advocate for the Department of Ed to have resources too, because they're often stripped in Oregon. You know, they don't have the sexual health people, they don't have school nurses, they don't have a variety of pieces that would support our work. And so we're not only an advocacy, my organization that I work for, it's not only an advocacy agency for school-based health centers, we advocate for those school nurses, we advocate for sexual health, we advocate for a variety of things that our education partners need to have too. We're lucky enough to work with our state program office, which is also funded through our state legislature. We have a staff of like 11 people at our state office that does a lot of research and planning, and you know, because we have general fund dollars. We have 77 school-based health centers in Oregon. So it just depends. You have to find out where are the gaps, where could I pull in some champions, you know, how do I get that bigger level discussion to happen? Because you need those partners so you're not fighting over the money. You know, well, you get that money. School nurses should have it. You know, let's all find money together and work together. That's our recent battle is school nurses. We have, we're the 43rd worst for school nurse ratio to students in the United States. And so the school nurses have been defunded over the years and they want our money. And so instead of being a turf war, we're going to advocate for you. And so we work on behalf with our lobbyists. We work to convene people, bring them together and say, let's work together on getting you funding. Let's not fight over funding. So it's add to the pot, not try to fight over it. That's our goal. So it's a tough battle, but you just have to find your lay of the landscape. And I'm sure there's other instances out here in the room that have other stories to tell. If you want to tell them, tell them.
Well, Addie, did you want to speak to how that's any different in Illinois? Okay, we'll take one more. Go ahead. Yep, that's you.
Thank you.
just a quick plug for no question, right? I think we can take one more. I just wanted to ask the panelists real quickly. It seems like, you know, one of the partners we haven't really heard about here, which is important, is crucial, are the impacts of the parents and the families and the involvement of the parents and the families. And so just a quick 10-second response by each of you on how to involve the parents, how to talk to the parents about the impact, et cetera.
And families, not just parents.
Okay, so historically, parent engagement and involving the parents has been very difficult, particularly at our school. However, when I am able to reach out to the families or the parents, it's been really great. And I've integrated myself kind of in a little bit with the school discipline, but almost as an alternative to keep their kids in school. So once the parents learn about the services that I'm providing and the services that our health center offers outside of my interventions, the feedback that I get is very good. We have an evening school program and they have a mandatory parent session. And so one day I went to that and they're like, where were you before my kid got kicked out and mandated this program? And I'm like, I was around, but like, I'm only one person. And so I think we have to continue to reach out to our parents, to our families. I think sometimes in the fast-paced environment of the school-based health center, you get kind of swept up in the day-to-day routine. So I think it's just important that we remind ourselves to continually reach out and try to engage the families, no matter how difficult that can be at times.
And as advocates as well, not only within the schools, but state level.
Right. I just want to add very quickly that particularly in our neighborhood that we're working in, Liberty City, which has a long history of organizations, entities pouring millions of dollars into that community with very little result and outcome, families having been reached out to for services and support, only to see those services and support disappear with the changing tide of funding or as people move on to other interests and priorities and goals. So engaging with our parents is extremely, and caregivers is extremely challenging. However, what we know is that if the person reaching out is perceived to be a member of the community, is engaged in that community, is there for the support and benefit of that community, the parents will respond. And as they're seeing positive outcomes with their children, that word of mouth gets around to other parents and caregivers. So it's important to build those relationships and really embed those relationships in communities that are challenged on every front you can imagine with just living day to day.
Anything to add, Tammy? You good? Okay, thank you guys so much for a really, really wonderful session.